Station number 13280, Reel 1.
Doug Evans, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Goodick, in Pembrokeshire, January the 27th, 1922.
What did your father do for a living?
My dad, he was a master mariner, working with the Great Western Railway. He'd been in Goodick since the port was established at Goodick for the cross-channel services between Fishguard and the port itself being at Goodick, and Ross Lair in particular in Southern Ireland.
Did you go to school in Goodick?
Yes, I went to school in the local council school. First of all to the infant school, and then to the council school. Mr. Anthony was our headmaster there. And later on I went to Fishguard, to the Fishguard County School.
How old were you when you finished school?
I finished school in 1938, when I was 16 and a half. The reason for that was that I'm afraid academically I didn't do all that well at the county school, and I wasn't successful at all with the Central Welsh Board. Other interests at the time that I'm afraid taken over to the detriment of my academic studies. So I failed the Central Welsh Board in 1938, and I then was given the opportunity to go to Swansea to join the business run by my uncle.
What kind of business was that?
It was a building business, building merchants, builders merchants. He was also selling wholesale ironmongery to the building trade. He also manufactured breeze blocks and concrete blocks for building. But the department that I was involved with was the roofing contract department, slating and tiling department, and I was taken into that and literally put in on the ground floor.
What was your reaction, if any, when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Oh, I well remember the day, the Sunday morning, when finally Mr. Chamberlain announced that we were at war. My reaction was that I was quite happy to get in there and do whatever I could when the time came to assist.
Were you dismayed or excited or exhilarated or what?
I wouldn't say exhilarated, but I don't think I was unduly dismayed. One had been almost brought to this point over such a long time. You were almost conditioned to it, you see, because 38 had come and gone. And here we are, after all this tension through the year, 39, finally war came. So one was almost conditioned into it, as I remember it.
What then? Were you in the bombing of Swansea?
No, I had left Swansea by then, because after about... with my uncle, I did a couple of years at the... Swansea Technical College during 38, and then during 39, and at that time my brother John, who was also with me, we went together into the business with my uncle. He had been conscripted. He was older than I, about 2.5 years older. I was looking for the opportunity of joining up, and so in 1940 I volunteered for the RAF. That was at the recruiting office in June, but that was before the bombing of Swansea.
What kind of a reaction did you get when you turned up?
At?
For the RAF.
Oh, fine. Quite happy. very pleased to be able to be there.
But were you accepted readily?
Yes, yes, I was accepted readily. I'd promised my uncle that I would undertake a trade which would be helpful to me, would it be necessary perhaps later on when the war was finished. At that time, I don't suppose he knew that the business would still be running after the war. And in fact, as it turned out, about a year later, he sold the business anyway. So there wouldn't have been a job there for me to go back to. But I remember having a long chat with him. He took me on a long walk down by the South Dock, a quiet area by the sea. He advised me on this, that if I was keen to join up, he was quite happy, of course, provided that I'd given it thought through what I was doing, and to be sure that I did something to ensure that I would have a good background for when the war was over.
Where did you do your training in the RAF?
Well, after joining at Uxbridge in August of 1940, my first training was not as a pilot, but as a flight mechanic. You first of all do your military training, of course, but I then went to St. Athan in Glamorganshire, near Cardiff. That was in September 1940, and I was there until January, doing my training as a flight mechanic airframe, a flight rigger.
What did you think of the quality of the training that you got?
Oh, excellent, excellent. I was very happy with it. And I was most interested in all this technical work, and also in the fact that the work was being done on the old biplanes, the single-engine biplanes of those times, which were not too long out of service in 1940, the Hawker Hart and the Hawker Hind. And there they were in this great hangar in St. Athan in rigging position, and we were doing our work, learning our trade on these lovely old aeroplanes.
Did you have any problems with the course?
No, I don't think so. No, that all went very straightforwardly.
Or any criticisms of the course?
No, I have none. No, it's a long time ago, of course, but at that time I was perfectly happy to be there, perfectly happy to be learning this trade, to be in the RAF, looking forward to becoming more active in support of what we were about.
What kind of a place was St. Athan to do your training?
Very big station. It was a pre-war station, very big station. Lots of hangars, permanent accommodations. Apart from that, I don't remember much about it. There was, of course, an MU there too, a maintenance unit of some size. Yeah, there was an airfield there. Airplanes were flying in and out. But, of course, our work was in the classroom, in the hangars, doing practical work and doing a certain amount of academic work as well.
Were there any German air raids on St. Athan whilst you were there?
No, no.
Because this was during the Blitz?
Yes, it was. I don't recall any attacks on St. Athan at that time.
And how did your training then progress?
Well, it went on until I left St. Athan, having completed my training in 17th of January 1941. And I was now an AC-2, aircraftman second class, flight mechanic airframe, otherwise flight rigger, waiting for my posting. So I went home on leave. And whilst home on leave, I received my posting notice to go to RAF Kidlington, which is near Oxford. And that posting was to 15 SFTS as a flight mechanic.
That means Service Flying Training School.
That's right.
What was the difference in the training here?
Well, this wasn't training now. I was trained as a flight rigger, and I was now posted to this unit as a flight mechanic, as a flight rigger.
So you're actually doing your job?
I was working the job on Oxford aeroplanes. It was an SFTS, a service flying training school, and I was posted to D flight, and I remember well the location of D flight, just off the road leading out of Oxford towards the town where Blenheim Palace is. The little road along there, from that road, is where I was on D flight doing this job on Oxford. The work of the station, of course, was to train pilots, and they were actually training pilots on this station. They were on their advanced training on Oxford aeroplanes.
And then after that, you went to St. John's Wood.
Yes, perhaps I might mention that whilst at Kidlington as a flight mechanic, I first of all went in for my examinations in that trade, and I was successful enough to gain first of all my AC1 and then LAC, leading aircraftman. But during this time too, because it was a pilot training station, it was possible for me to, in my time off, to go to the classrooms where the students were being given their other lessons, lessons appropriate to their training as a pilot, notably navigation, meteorology, that sort of thing. So I took the opportunity of attending these lectures to learn what I could about this, because really I was hoping that I might be able to remaster to aircrew in due course myself. Whilst all this was going on, I was also lucky enough to be allowed to play in the station band. I quite enjoyed that. Before I left Goodick, I had been for 3 years or so in the Goodick Brass Band. So here was an opportunity to keep that going. I'm afraid I haven't kept it going since, but I did for the time that I was at Kidlington, and enjoyed playing with the band, giving concerts in one or other of the station messes. My time there was, I look back with a lot of pleasure all round. Very nice. I applied through the usual channels to remuster to aircrew. And quite early on in the year, 41, I was asked to go and see the station commander, group captain. I was interviewed by him. He suggested that perhaps I'd give it some more thought and he'd like to see me later on in the year again. So I reminded those concerned that he'd made this promise, and I went back to see him, and I was very grateful to him that he recommended that I should go forward for aircrew training. That was how I left Kidlington to go to my next posting to St. John's Wood, Lord's Cricket Ground. Virtually all of the aircrew trainees of those days will remember their weeks at Lord's and living in the flats around St. John's Wood, attending the different meetings and medical and other requirements in Lord's itself.
It's interesting that you wanted to become aircrew, in view of the fact that there would be much more danger for you.
Yes, but I didn't seem to, that didn't seem to matter as far as I was concerned, because whilst I was at Swansea, and for a number of years, I'd been interested in aeroplanes in particular, though I'd been interested in ships as a youngster, my dad being a master mariner, but somehow my interest was redirected towards aeroplanes way long before this. I used to take the aeroplane every week and take a great interest in what was going on with the where the RAF was concerned. I distinctly remember buying books about Captain Ball VC and some of the great World War One pilots, and somehow I suppose one is conditioned into this kind of thinking, and going into air crew, as far as I was concerned, was just a step forward. The danger, if there was any considered to be at the time, didn't seem to matter as far as I was concerned.
Now, I think that you did most of your training across the Atlantic.
Yes, I did. Yes.
Can you tell me about how that happened?
Yes, it's unusual in a way, I suppose. A lot of people trained in Canada, of course. So a lot of people would have trained across the Atlantic. Others would have trained in South Africa and Rhodesia. I went across the Atlantic in early 1942, expecting to be trained in Canada as well. I'd met my brother over there 3 weeks after he left the UK. And whereas he, in fact, went on a Canadian course, I discovered that I was to go down to Georgia in the USA under what was known as the Arnold Scheme. The scheme was named after General Arnold. And this was to be trained with and by the U.S. Army Air Corps. Particularly interesting experience.
Whereabouts in America did you do most of your training with the Arnold Scheme?
Well, with the Arnold Scheme, after a highly interesting train journey from Moncton, we started out at Albany in Georgia. That was my primary flying school. They did their training in three sections, primary, basic, and advanced. And my primary training was at Dar Aerotech, a private, what had previously been a private school, now incorporated into their training system. There I did my primary training.
What did you think of the American methods of teaching flying?
Well, the American methods of teaching flying as a practice of flying airplanes was absolutely excellent. No doubt about that at all. What I think we found was that in the academic side of it, at that time, they really weren't anywhere near up to what was going on this end in the RAF. We had, all of us, completed 3 months initial training wing, in my case at Scarborough. During that time, we had lectures on meteorology, navigation. There were some textbooks that we were regularly looking at, studying and working with. And really, as one came out of the ITW, as I did in about December or early January 40, December 41, early January 42, one was fairly well up in the quite complicated navigational exercises. We found that this was not the case in the classroom in the training we did in America. But certainly, if there was any shortfall there, it was fully made up by the excellence of the training, the practical business of flying aeroplanes.
What about American service discipline as compared with RAF discipline?
Oh, it is very different, yes. The Americans at that time conformed to what I understood was called the honor system. The honor system in the classroom was very strict, and You were required not to hesitate to inform an invigilating officer if you saw someone looking at a crib during an exam. This seemed to be the principle, very strong principle, to which they worked. Because we had their cadet system, but we also had these West Point people. So this reflected, I think, West Point discipline. Just prior to our being there, the business of eating square meals, that is, raising your hands vertically and horizontally to your mouth, came into it as well. But that had been dropped, I think, because the RAF boys found that the best thing we could do is stick together, support each other as best we can. And I think there was a certain amount of antagonism, antipathy towards this sort of thing, and they relented to a degree. So by the time I was there, starting in about June 1942, this very, very peculiar overall system of discipline had been amended to a degree, I think. The business of demerits certainly continued. Now, demerits was a system by which, if you didn't make your bed up correctly, or if there was some other misdemeanor, you would be awarded demerits. And for each demerit, at the weekend, instead of being given leave to leave the station, you would walk an hour with your pack on your back. As I remember it, you'd walk 50 minutes and then you'd have 10 minutes break. So one demerit was 1 hour. You walk 50 minutes, 10 minutes off, and then you'd walk the next one. It went that way. So the system of demerits, according to standard discipline in the barrack room and that sort of thing, certainly continued. It was very interesting.
Did you get any?
No, I have to say I managed to steer clear, and I never did walk a single one. It's not to say that I wasn't deserving of having done so, but I did manage to get away with not having walked any.
It was undetected.
I would prefer to think that it was. I certainly could give no other explanation than that to it.
I don't quite understand what this honour system of service discipline was. Does it mean informing on the other people?
It's perhaps at this late stage, and all these years later, it's difficult to comment upon it. But yes, I think it was. I think it was a system by which, in the classroom, certainly, one was expected. I believe the Americans were, at that time, this West Point system permeating down through the cadet system as a whole, and we were deeply involved with all this because we were part of it. We were trained along with them in their system. Yes, I believe the honor system did require people to do that, and we found that quite impossible to live with. You couldn't inform on a colleague. It was just whatever, whether you thought he was right or wrong, it's neither here nor there. But the system as such didn't seem to us to be all that wonderful.
Did instances of informing occur, to your knowledge?
They were rare. I believe I recall just one or two cases of it happening during the time that I was there. Not to any extent, as I recall.
Was that amongst the Americans or the British?
Oh, amongst the Americans, of course, yes.
But you didn't stay at Albany. You also moved to Macon and Valdosta?
Yes, that's right.
Why were those moves made?
Well, because I was at primary training until the 6th of August 1942, at Dar Aerotech in Albany. And then on that date, I moved to Cochrane Field, Macon, Georgia, for my basic flying training. The aeroplane was the Vultee BT-13A, single-engined low-wing monoplane. So that was the intermediate stage of training, the way that the Americans then did it. And here I came upon certain RAF instructors who'd previously themselves gone through the Arnold system, and at the end of their training had been selected as flying instructors, and I met certain of these who were actually flying instructors here at Cochrane Field.
And Moody Field?
Yes, well, after leaving Cochrane in October 1942, I then went to Moody Field in Valdosta, and I was there for my advanced flying training until the 13th of December. This was on an advanced airplane for its day, Beechcraft AT-10, which was a twin-engined airplane, very up-to-date, very modern airplane, with electric undercarriage operation, as I remember, and flaps operation, electric. It was quite a, and being a twin-engine monoplane, quite an advanced airplane. Two Lycoming engines, interesting airplane to fly, and I didn't seem to have any problems, and it all went fairly well for me. I must say, I was very pleased the way it had all gone.
What was the attitude of the American public towards RAF people
that time? Absolutely fantastic. They were wonderful to us. They were absolutely wonderful to us. In our time off, because we were in Georgia, and I, of course the three stations I mentioned are all in Georgia, we had the opportunity in our time off to go to the local town, of course, Macon or Valdosta or Albany. I do recall going to Atlanta quite a lot, and there meeting very good friends. We all had our own experiences of meeting lovely American people who who gave us such wonderful hospitality. And I met, first of all, a Mr. Trammell Scott, who had been in the American Army in the First World War. Through him, his lady, and I often stayed at their home. They had two daughters, and both these daughters are with their, well, they're in the U.S. today, and we remain in touch with them even to this day. In addition, though, on one occasion when I was at the USO, because on entry you always put your name into the register and your home address, and I was called to the desk at the entrance to meet a Mr. Thomas James. Mr. Thomas James, as it turned out, a resident of Atlanta and a successful businessman. He owned and lived in a large block of flats. He'd left my home, village near my home, Goodick, village called Letterston. He'd left there around about the turn of the century, around about, perhaps I could find it here somewhere. Mr. Thomas James